This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Laura Haywood. If you are a theater lover like me, especially if you follow the New York theater scene, you may have heard of Laura Haywood. On social media, she is known as Broadway Girl NYC, a handle she created anonymously 10 years ago on a whim to entertain herself. 5 years ago, during a TED Talk, Laura revealed herself as the writer behind this joyful character she had created on Twitter, and being Broadway's most influential fan became her career. She is a TV, radio, and podcast host, writer, and social media consultant. But the real reason I wanted to chat with her so badly is that both personally and professionally, she's truly one of my role models. When I first started RDU on Stage, I did a lot of research and found Laura's profile on social media. I was inspired by her positivity, moved by her candidness about her struggle with depression, and excited about the fact that she is a true champion and cheerleader for the Broadway theater community, which is exactly the kind of thing I'm trying to do for our theater community right here in the Triangle. So I wrote Laura a fan letter, hoping I didn't sound like too much of a stalker, and I asked her if I could interview her. And guess what? She said yes. Here's our conversation.
I've always, I think, even before I discovered radio, I've always been a broadcaster. I just, for most of my life, I had an audience of one, or maybe an audience of zero, in that I was writing in my journal every single day, starting when I was about 10 years old. I just had opinions and I wanted to get them out of me. Nobody read my journal that I know of or has ever, including me. I don't even really go back and read my journals from those days, although I still have them. So you could say it was an audience of zero. I just never felt like keeping my opinions or my enthusiasm inside made sense. So I, no matter what my platform was, whether it was a college radio station that had five listeners at any given time, or, you know, a bigger radio platform, or when Twitter came along, a social media platform, I just wanted to share what I was thinking about because it felt too big to keep inside me. So I think that one way or another, I was going to find a platform for sharing that enthusiasm and finding other people that maybe felt the same way, but it definitely was not a savvy marketing strategy. It wasn't strategic. And I think if it had been, then my content wouldn't have read as authentic, and that would have made it not successful for me. It was the fact that I really was just sort of purely joyful for the sake of being purely joyful, not to make money, not to get an audience, not to manipulate, you know, the industry to give me a place at the table. It wasn't any of that. I just, you know, it was sort of like an adult version of a little kid dancing like nobody's watching.
So how has, I mean, you've been doing this, I don't know, almost, I feel like it's almost 10 years. It feels like a long time. How has theater fandom, Broadway fandom changed and evolved since you first moved to New York and since you first started doing this? Because I feel like even since I was growing up, the fandom around theater, and I don't know if it has to do with Hamilton, if it has to do with earlier shows like Rent, but the fandom has changed a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to know because I was not aware of theater fandom really until I moved here in 2005. So I can only speak to the last 15 years. But even then, it wasn't until like mid to late 2006 when I saw Spring Awakening for the first time that I even really considered it. My first year or so here, I went to see maybe one show every 2 or 3 months, but it didn't feel like the kind of thing that I could do every day. I wasn't aware of lotteries or rushes beyond the fact that I knew that Rent had reinvented this or invented this idea of low price tickets for, you know, people who couldn't afford the fancy traditional Broadway seats. I guess that my experience with it can only date back to Spring Awakening. And even then there was a social media component. So I've never known the fandom without that. At that time it was MySpace, and Spring Awakening had some young producers who, and they might be the ones who first understood that it could be used for marketing. They created a MySpace, I don't know if they were called groups or pages or what, but specifically for Spring Awakening fans to interact. So I joined that MySpace group and started interacting with fans there. And I also lived less than a block from that theater at the time. So on my way home, I would just pop in and say, like, do you still have any tickets at the, I don't know if they're probably like $35 or $40 level at that point. So I ended up going 14 times in the first year. The place I encountered it the most, other than on MySpace, was in rush lines, because there was this group or this contingent that wanted to see every understudy in Spring Awakening. And we would all get to the theater at 4 a.m. when we knew the understudies were going on, to make sure we got rush tickets for those days. And it was there that they would start, that I started hearing people talking about other shows they loved. I was pretty focused on that one show, but then I heard some people saying that, well, when the Tony nominations came out, it was either going to be Spring Awakening or Grey Gardens, because Grey Gardens was that season and it was so good. And I was like, oh, well, if it can be compared to this, I better go see that too. I remember it didn't feel competitive at that point, at least not to me. There wasn't a lot of like, well, I've seen it this many times, so I'm a bigger fan than you. There was a lot of like, oh, well, if you're going, can you grab me a ticket? And then next time I'll grab a ticket for you. And it felt more collaborative. I think social media and fandom have really fed each other, and they've increased the idea of FOMO. Like social media has really increased the idea of FOMO, fear of missing out. And it isn't enough to listen to an album anymore. You have to see the show. And sometimes it isn't enough to see the show. You have to be in the front row. And sometimes it isn't enough to be in the front row. You have to get a selfie at the stage door. And sometimes it isn't enough to get a selfie at the stage door. You have to be backstage. And sometimes it isn't enough to be backstage if you're not on a first name basis with the star, because people like me share these experiences that can maybe make other people feel like they are not getting as much access as somebody else is. And that's one of the reasons that I try to keep things positive and let people live vicariously through me, instead of risking people feeling like I'm rubbing something in their face or claiming superiority. I really believe that we're all the same. We're all fans. We all love this art form. And I want to give people a lens to live through me versus trying to make them feel left out. To go back to your original question, I think it might be an issue of supply and demand, where even when I moved to New York, and even when I was going to shows all the time, I wasn't really aware of the fact that I didn't know what anybody else was doing, because in the MySpace group, we really just talked about what understudies were going on at what time. I didn't know like how many people were getting their picture taken with so-and-so. And I was never involved in the message boards that I have heard there's been so much toxicity on over the years. I didn't know about them or get involved in them. Or have any expertise to claim if I had been there. Now, and since I was deep in the Spring Awakening fandom, although that wasn't a word that we used at the time, barricades started showing up. And that was the first show that where I remember that happening, where people had to be held back. When that show started, the actors would come out of the stage door and there'd be like a little knot of us standing there waiting, and they'd say hi and they knew us and they'd sign our playbills. But it wasn't until maybe after the Tonys for that show that people started showing up en masse to the, and like screaming and, you know, needing to be held back for the actor's own safety and sort of keep order. And I think that really has to do with the fact that there was more demand than there was supply. There were more people who wanted to be interacting with the stars than there were stars to interact with them or moments after the show. And so things had to just be organized differently.
If you could design kind of a roadmap or rule book for audiences and fans of this medium, what might it say?
I mean, kindness is number one. I think we all have so much more in common than we have that is in conflict with each other. And if everybody just gave each other the benefit of the doubt that we're all doing our best, there would be a lot, it would be a lot, like just the whole culture of audiences would be better. I mean, I think about how angry I get when somebody's phone goes off. But then there was one time in hundreds of theater performances, one time when an alarm went off on my phone, even though I had it on airplane mode, that alarm went straight through and I felt horrible. And I was like, I just want to tell everybody around me like how horrible I feel. And that's changed the way I react when somebody else's phone goes off, because instead of being like, they're an idiot, I go like, I bet that's the one time they forgot. And I bet they feel worse than I do. And, you know, there are certainly people who are, if somebody's phone rings and rings and rings and rings, and then it rings again after intermission, you know, then of course you're going to be annoyed. But I always try to go to forgiveness and empathy and could that have happened to me? And what if it had, and how would I want people to think for, you know, for me? I also think that, you know, kindness towards the performers, towards the ushers, towards the front of house staff, the people selling cocktails, the people selling merchandise, that if we could all just smile and make eye contact and say hello, the whole experience would be better. And then there's the issue of being competitive. I just think that being an audience member is not a competitive sport. It's a collaborative sport. We're all there for the love of the same thing. And when people start to say, well, I've seen 20 different Elphabas, or, you know, I've seen such and such show on four continents, or, you know, I liked it before it was cool or whatever, then all that does is get people's guards up and make them feel defensive at best and offensive at worst, and people start to feel less than. And this community that a lot of us found found solace in, because we're outsiders, you know, we begin to become the people that we were trying to escape from, you know. And I've seen too much fandom that feels hierarchical, and I just don't want anything to do with that. We need to practice empathy, try not to use access as a currency, and just treat each other with kindness. I mean, that's the playbook. That's the rule book.
And then at the same time, something I love that I heard you say is that theaters should view audiences not just as seat buyers, but kind of as collaborators.
Yeah. So theater without an audience doesn't exist. It's a rehearsal. The only way for theater to exist is for people to be engaging with it. And unlike a movie, which can exist in a vacuum, theater wouldn't survive if there weren't people filling those seats. And if you ask anybody who's ever done a one-person show how they're able to just have a conversation with themselves, they tend to say the same thing, which is that they're not having a conversation with themselves. The other actor in the scene is the audience. And that the way that the audience reacts, whether it's a laugh, whether it's silence, whether it's, you know, emotion, whether they're making eye contact with one person or just getting a vibe from the entire room, the reaction from the audience changes the way they deliver their next line. And those actors always understand that they are collaborating with the audience. I think that producers who understand that concept, that we are all collaborating on this art form, and it wouldn't exist if it didn't have all of us on both sides of that proscenium involved, there's an inherent respect for the audience that I think audience members and fans can intuit that makes them feel respected. And for I, for one, when if a production makes me feel condescended to, or like all I am is the dollars that I'm spending, then that's not going to feel like a community to me. I'm not going to feel like I belong there or like I'm part of something. You know, if I walk through the door and the usher is like, "Hey, you're back," I'm like, "Oh, I feel seen," you know? Or if I get an email from a mailing list that's like, "We noticed that you've seen this show 4 times, you know, the 5th time we're giving you 50% off." That's never happened, by the way, but I think it should. I think there should be like a punch card, you know? Or if I am at a stage door and somebody comes up and they're like, "Oh, I saw your tweet the other day," I'm going to feel like that show belongs to me. And that's going to make me sort of into a de facto marketing team for the show, because I'm going to tell everybody I know that they should go and see that show, because it might be my favorite show because I love the music, but it also might be my favorite show because they make me feel like I belong.
So something else we have in common is I have 2 children, and when they were younger, I spent all my time volunteering in the schools trying to promote arts education. You sit on the board for Story Pirates. Can you tell me what Story Pirates is and why you think arts education is so important?
Oh my gosh, yes. I'm more excited to talk about this than anything else. Story Pirates is a group, it's an arts education nonprofit that, or I should say, Story Pirates is a multimedia entertainment company. I sit on the board of the nonprofit arm, which is Story Pirates Changemakers. Story Pirates Entertainment has a podcast. We have produced several books, and we do a lot of live shows that anybody can come and see. And we create and produce sketch comedy and musical comedy based on original stories written by elementary school kids. Story Pirates Changemakers goes into Title I schools, which are the low-income schools in and around New York City. And we engage students in creative writing workshops and then perform stories that came out of their own imaginations on a huge scale, sometimes with thousands of people in the audience from the school, the families, and the communities of these kids, many of whom have had their arts programs slashed or completely discontinued. We take the ideas from their imaginations and create larger than life shows that bring those stories to life. The idea being that once children understand that their ideas are important and that learning and school can lead to something fun, they're more likely to show up for school. They're more likely to finish school. They're more likely to attend college. They're more likely to see themselves as unique individuals. And most importantly, I think a lot of these kids, especially in the Title I schools, have been told that when they use their imaginations, when they play, that they're being bad. They link being creative with being naughty. And when they are able to be silly and ridiculous, and when they're encouraged to play and sometimes be loud, they feel more at home, and they feel more like they are, like, again, it's about being seen. They feel more like they're seen for who they truly are, and that learning and having fun are not mutually exclusive. We also have a company, or a leg of our company, that's based in LA, and we do national tours every year as well. Plus, I cannot stress enough how much fun the Story Pirates podcast is. And a lot of the stories we perform as radio plays on the Story Pirates podcast do come out of those Title I schools. We also encourage kids from all backgrounds and all over the world to send in, for their parents to send us in original stories they've written. And we send back what we call story love, which is a letter of support that's very specific to each story to every single kid who sends in a story. And we get tens of thousands of stories a year. So we partner with companies, including Google, NBC, other really big companies, but also like gyms and groups of friends who do it as birthday parties to help us write those story love letters. So every single kid can be told how much we love their story and specifically what we loved about it. So if you don't mind me throwing a plug out there, storypirates.org is a great place for people to, get involved, whether that means like helping us to find schools to perform in, whether it's sending in a story that your kid wrote or a story you wrote when you were a kid, which is one of my favorites, when someone as an adult finds something in their parents' or grandparents' story storage and is like, this is hilarious, maybe you can make something of this, or to donate money or to offer to spend some time with your friends or your company to help us love on the stories that those kids so carefully and with so much humor and delight craft for us.
I love that. And I will put a link in the episode notes as well. One of the reasons I really wanted to have you on this podcast and interview you is because what you've done for the Broadway community, being a cheerleader and a champion for the theater, is what I have tried to emulate and do for the theater community here. What I really admire about you is you've been very candid about the fact that being so positive, being happy, being joyful, that's not always come easy for you. And I will put a link to the TED Talk as well. But in your fabulous TED Talk, you say you made a decision to be happy and you turned that into a practice. So can you talk to me a little bit about practicing joy, practicing happiness?
Yes. The first thing I need to say is that deciding to be happy is not enough. And I had a lot of people around me. I suffered from debilitating chronic depression when I was going through puberty, especially when I was in high school. And so it was sort of on the later end of puberty for me, but it was absolutely biologically and hormonally driven. I had people around me telling me that I had power and that I could decide to be happier. And that felt bogus to me, because of course, who wouldn't decide to be happy? But when I realized that what I could choose was to pursue happiness instead of defining myself as somebody who was unhappy, then even if I didn't get there, the success was in the pursuit. And the pursuit became the practice. One of the very first examples of this is I remember probably even before high school, my mother told me that if I looked in the mirror and looked myself in the eye once a day and said, I love you, that it would feel ridiculous and that it would feel stupid and it might feel untrue. But if I did it every day, eventually I would believe it. And I remember telling her she didn't understand me and being like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I'm not doing it. But I had a mirror in my bedroom and I started doing it. And it literally took years. But at some point I was like, oh my gosh, this ridiculous, stupid feeling thing actually worked. My favorite thing about that story is that her mother had told her the same thing and she'd reacted exactly the same way, that it was dumb and she wasn't doing it. And her mother didn't understand her, but that they're like neurologically, and of course I'm not a doctor, but I read a lot about this. Neurologically, you can create habits for yourself through repetition. And this is the positive interpretation of fake it till you make it, you know, and I've also learned about other crazy ways to pursue happiness in the teeny tiniest of ways. There are ways that we have all heard about, like socialize more or practice self-care or exercise, or there are ways that I think people think about joy. But then there are other crazy things, like one of my favorites is if you take a pencil or a pen or chopstick or a straw and you put it in your mouth and clench it horizontally and clench it between your back teeth as far back as you can, that the act of pulling your cheeks out to the side, you're forcing your mouth into a kind of grimace, but your brain interprets that as a smile and will actually release a little bit of dopamine that will make you physically feel happier. It doesn't change your circumstances. It doesn't cost anything. Nobody needs to see it, but it can actually physically change your brain chemistry. And it's not like if your dog dies, if you clench a straw in your teeth, suddenly you're not going to care that your dog died. It's not a magical fix, but it is a tiny thing that you have control over. And so I have just started researching what are ways to kind of hack happiness, and I just do them. You know, I just do as many of those things as I can, especially the ones that don't cost any money, because what do I have to lose?
And I love that you're sharing this, because so many of my listeners are young people. A lot of them are young performers, and I see on Facebook all the time them posting things like, I'm having a really bad day today, or I just woke up and I can already tell it's going to be one of those days. Send me pictures of your dogs, or send me cat pictures. And I think you speaking out about this and having people take kind of ownership of making a conscious decision to work on happiness, work on a positivity, work towards that. I love that.
I want to take the opportunity to give a huge high five to the people who are saying, send me cat pictures. Because if someone's having a heart, because those people are pursuing happiness, they're not saying, I just woke up and my day's already ruined and there's nothing that can be done about it. They're like, I know that cat pictures make me smile, and I am going to put the word out to ask for that help. It feels like nothing. It feels like, or it can be easily judged as something that is passive or silly or, not serious. But the truth is they have made the decision to pursue their own happiness in that moment, to pursue the tiny extra burst of joy that will help them get out of bed. And every time we get out of bed, it becomes easier in the long run to get out of bed the next time. And I think so little celebration is done of those things that maybe for the average non-depressed person are quote unquote easy or obvious. Yeah, everybody has to get out of bed for school in the morning. Stop acting like it's some major big deal for you, because for some people it is a major big deal. It's kind of like if you were born with one leg, then running around the block one time would be heroic. And you can't be like, yeah, everybody has to run around the block sometimes, because their circumstances are different. And I can tell you that sometimes I feel like the emotional equivalent of somebody who was born with one leg and went on to run a marathon, because my circumstances were different. And I was born with a deficiency, or at least I went through a period of my life in which the deficiency was kind of everything that I could comprehend. But I continued to get up. And somehow, at some point, I realized that even when it looked like I was doing less than everyone around me, I was working as hard as I could, and I was making incremental progress. And it was the progress, not my point as I was being related to or compared to the people around me. It was the progress compared to myself that mattered.
My dad used to call it, I went through a very difficult time when I was in college and had several months where I just didn't want to get out of bed. I was having trouble functioning. There was not social media back then. So you couldn't reach out and say, please send me good vibes, send me the cat pictures, send me dog pictures. And my dad used to say to me, you know, it's just small victories. If you get up and you take a shower, if you get up and you get dressed, that is a small victory for you. And, you know, eventually those small victories kind of add up and become a habit.
Building habits sucks, and it's hard, and it's easy is not the point. The point is doing whatever you can to make it the tiniest bit easier, or to even project into the future how the discomfort can become more palatable. I use fitness metaphors a lot, and I did in the TED Talk you referenced. There might be people around you lifting 100 pounds at the gym, and you might not be able to lift 10. But if you lift 5 pounds often enough, eventually you're going to be able to lift 10. And when you do, it's going to feel amazing. And it's not, and you're still only lifting a tenth of what other people might seem to think is easy, but you're doing twice as much as what you could do before. And if you concentrate on comparing yourself to yourself, then it just becomes so much easier to survive in the world and not be like brought down by the idea that other people have the same challenges or the same, circumstances as you.
So do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
We've seen so many shows close recently or that are about to close. So looking forward to this next season, are there any shows coming to New York that you are or opening soon that you're just really excited about that maybe should be on all of our radar in case we're taking a trip soon?
So the show that I think I'm most excited about right now is Sing Street, which is based on a movie, but it's not a movie I ever saw. So it doesn't feel like it's based on a movie to me. It's a show about sort of rebellious youth. And that is a theme that, you know, ever since Spring Awakening, and maybe I guess even Les Mis, which, you know, is also about a bunch of rebellious youth, that has always really appealed to me. I saw it at New York Theater Workshop this season, and it's, or, you know, like a few months ago, and it's going to be coming to Broadway in the next few months. I don't remember the exact date. So that's sort of maybe a sleeper hit. Then there are some that are some shows coming that are based on popular properties, revivals, like Company starring Patti LuPone. Katrina Lenk is playing the leading role in a role that's traditionally played by a man. And I'm really excited, especially as somebody who went through my entire 30s single in New York City, to see the story of a woman single in New York City and figuring out how to navigate when all of her friends are coupled up. So I'm really excited to see Company. Caroliner Change is coming back, which was a, you know, Tony winning role for Tanya Pinkins, and Anika Noni Rose won a Tony for that show as well. And so it's coming from London. There are so many shows coming up that I could just be like, see everything. But I know that for most people, that's not an option. But I would say that those three are a good place to start. Plus, I can't get enough of Jagged Little Pill, which already opened. I think a lot of people think it's just going to be sort of like a Mamma Mia-esque contrived story put into, like, with Alanis Morissette's 1995 album sort of surrounding the story. It's actually basically a brand new original story that utilizes Alanis Morissette's music from Jagged Little Pill, from her other albums, and even some original music written just for this show, and doesn't feel like a jukebox musical or like a 25 years ago throwback at all. So I'd put those ones on your list. Also, I need to just say everybody needs to see Beetlejuice. It is probably my favorite thing on Broadway right now. It was last season's show, but it really has gotten a second wind and is doing great. And that's the one where when I happen to have a free night, I go online and see if I can grab a last minute ticket to Beetlejuice. So that's another one. See that.
You can follow Laura Haywood on social media at Broadway Girl NYC. Find her online, listen to her podcast, and do good with her by contributing to Story Pirates. I'll put links to her website and to the Story Pirates website in the episode notes. On a personal note, I'm headed to Kentucky this week to be a presenter at the Southeastern Theater Conference, SETC, along with some of my friends at the Women's Theater Festival. I hope to see some of you there. Be sure to follow me on social media at RDU on Stage for updates from the conference. Of course, if you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, become a patron of this program, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.